You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is Wednesday, the 13th of October, 2021. As some of you must have heard, I have been recovering from COVID-19 for the last 3 weeks, which is why I've been out of commission. This stuff is no joke. I always thought that when I got it, we were all going to get it at some point, that, you know, I'm a healthy man, I never get sick, that it's going to be no big deal, maybe I won't have any symptoms at all, that won't last for it. Well, I was wrong. I was on my back for at least a week and a half of this. Some of it I simply don't remember. I never had any breathing problems, thank God Almighty. God saw me through very high temperatures. And you start thinking some very bizarre thoughts when it goes over 103. And I kept, you don't know what to do with yourself. You're constantly laying down. You can't sleep. You can't get up. You can't sit up. You can't do anything. It was I've never been this sick in my entire life. I had the flu one time. I was teaching back in, I think it was 05. Then my kidney stones in 17. And that's it. I really don't know how to be sick. Or what it is to have a fever, but, I got an education. Some of you may have heard we lost the great Ed DeVries to COVID. Ed is a good friend of mine. Some of you know him from the Barnes Review Radio. He was a Baptist minister in Maryland. And I heard from Paul Angel from the Barnes Review the other day that it hit him and he's gone, which is a huge loss for us. Thank God Dave Gahari will pull through. We were wondering about him for a while. So many people have, you know, having it sometimes can go, could be nothing. It could be the worst experience of your life. And I've never been this sick. And as my temperature would climb, I would get very anxious. I was having awful nightmares. This was a little bit of what hell must be like. And, I don't have to get, I'm definitely not getting the vaccine. I'm going to get the vaccine anyway, but now I'm definitely not going to get it. I don't care what they say. I'm not supporting any of that stuff or masks or any of that nonsense. But this is a very real phenomenon. And if I had any other health problems, God knows what would have happened. It may not have gone as well as it did. So for those who've been praying for me, thank you. And I know I've been gone a while, but for very good reason. And the loss of Ed is still shocking to me. I just had an interview with him, some of you may know, for the Barnes Review. And, of course, I've always been associated with them. I was just talking to him. I don't know if he had a health problem. I don't know any details, unfortunately, there. So, this was a very serious matter. And thank you for your patience and for your financial support, despite the fact that I haven't really done anything to earn it. I think I got something out on Patreon on the French election with Le Pen. back in 17. That was published only in print. I think that was in the American Free Press, and it's not been published anywhere else. This more electoral fraud than what the regime will do. But I also, a few days ago, this isn't relevant to what I'm going to talk about today, but I saw the Sopranos prequel movie, The Many Saints of Newark, the reference to the last name was Asante. I like the series. I was a big fan of it. That's the part of New Jersey where I'm from. I'm from Union County. And they reference many places that I knew as a kid. Everyone talked like that when I was growing up. And the series was extraordinary. The acting is some of the best that's ever been on the small screen. The great James Gandolfini is really an extraordinary persona. But the movie was a nightmare. It was essentially had nothing to do with The Sopranos. It was about essentially the rise of the black mafia in Newark and the Newark riots. That was the heart of it all. None of the storylines of the Sopranos series were even mentioned. This was a nonsense black history. It had nothing to do with the series. It was awful. It was a waste of time. And what I could, the only thing I could think of is that the regime went to David Chase and said, you know, there's way too many white people in the Sopranos. And they're all Italians, pretty much. We need to fix that. So now it centered on the Newark riots. There's black nationalist speeches in there. And every once in a while, there'll be some reference to Soprano's character. It was, it answered no questions. It had no plot. It had no purpose other than to satisfy the regime. It's one of the worst movies I've ever seen. And David Chase should be ashamed of himself, although I know that a lot of pressure was put on him for that. For those of you who know the show, I mean, I was expecting the Fitch-LaManna card game to be explained, and Richie Aprile, and all the different family dynamics. You know, even Livia was in it for just a few scenes. It didn't destroy the series, of course, but it destroyed the veneer of David Chase. And the entire thing, there really was no purpose to it. There was no discernible plot line. I couldn't even describe it to you. It was a series of images blacks attacking whites. So apparently there weren't enough black actors in the series, so they said, well, David, here's what you're going to do. And it was an embarrassment. For those of you who haven't seen it yet, please don't bother. It was a huge disappointment. My God, I'm sitting in the theater. So I'd rather have COVID again than to go through this nonsense. And the phenomenon is a disgusting one, where you have whole empires like the NFL, institutions like Saturday Night Live, I was a big fan of them going back when I was a kid, deliberately destroying themselves, got even racing, which I never got into, but deliberately destroying themselves by alienating their base. I mean, these guys are billionaires anyway. It doesn't make any difference. They have other sources of income. NFL, what is down 50%, 40%. So many of the SNL is down 40%. They've been reduced to doing these skits that have brand names in them to pay the bills. And they won't stop. They'll destroy themselves. They'll lose billions rather than reverse themselves in this stuff. Now, this season has been a little different. It's not been as bad. I think one time I saw a white person in an advertisement, so that's a bit of an improvement. But these institutions, as I predicted many years ago, they will destroy themselves rather than go against the reigning ideology. You know, David Chase has destroyed his reputation with this nonsense. I'm surprised that he even let it let it go out. It's being ripped in the press as being incoherent and things like that. But that's really the phenomenon, that the left, those controlling it, are so overwhelmingly powerful that, you know, these billionaires will destroy their own institutions rather than go against it, even in a symbolic way. And, you know, so it's been a bit of a disaster out there. I haven't been following much. I don't know what's going on. I'm just getting back into the swing of things. I'd say I'm about 90% back. I am friends are taking me away for my 50th birthday, which is in a few days, to South Carolina. Which is a wonderful thing, to have people willing to do that. And I'll be there. Of course, nothing will change. I'll be live on Thursday and everything will be the same. But I'll be there for a week to be able to get away, because I can't stand these four walls anymore. So with all that, thank you for your patience and understanding. And again, I have to appeal to you to continue to help and support me financially to get back on my feet. And I think I'm going to make it worth your while, because what I'm going to do is what I think is going to be a two-part lecture on pre-Christian Byzantium. That is to say, those states and leagues, institutions that functioned roughly in the area of Byzantium and the Bosporus on the Black Sea prior to St. Constantine, prior to the foundation of Christian Byzantium, the Byzantine Empire. And they center around roughly four places: Pontus, Bithynia, Thrace, and Pergamon. And we're talking about the era roughly 500 BC to 250 or 200 AD. And it's extremely important. I mean, this really is the cradle of Western civilization here. And yet it's not well known. When I put this paper together some time ago, it was very, you know, until the Romans were able to organize things, it was just chaos, and you don't have a lot of popular knowledge about the subject. It's not something that's discussed even among historians. And it gets very obscure, but the obscurity has nothing to do with its significance. So, I don't know how far I'm going to get today with that. I'm just happy to be breathing, actually, so I'm in a pretty good mood. But this is something, essentially, we're talking about the foundation of Eastern Europe, the foundation of what became the Byzantine Empire of St. Constantine and Theodosius. So, prior to Constantine, Byzantium was a significant part of Southeastern Europe. The Golden Horn, which was essential, the protected, very easily defended harbor, was its main attraction. Its wealth and significance was in linking Asia, Africa, and Europe together. It was a crossroads of the planet. And whoever controlled the straits and its surrounding hinterlands had a massive strategic and certainly financial advantage. But pre-Christian Byzantium is obscure in the sense that there's really no boundaries here. It was part of a broad trading network, stretching roughly from, you know, Central Asia to Spain. So we're talking about one of the nodal points in this network. But in doing so, we realize that controlling Byzantium and its suburbs was of immense importance. And so I want to summarize the civilizations that essentially contained Byzantium, at least at some point in their history. So we're putting it into context. We're putting the rise of, I mean, you know, God chose the Byzantine Empire to be one of his main vehicles. And we're talking about then the sort of the prehistory of the building of that empire, of Eastern Rome. The city, of course, predates Constantine, but it was not self-sufficient, and its history has to be connected with societies around it. Byzantium was a smaller yet powerful strategic town, which was coveted by nearly all larger Greek states in the area. So, in dealing with this, with the closest, you know, institutions of societies to Byzantium would be then on the shores of the northern Black Sea, Thrace, which contains Byzantium, Pergamon and Bithynia, which is across the straits from Byzantium, and the Bosporus Kingdom itself, which essentially is Byzantium, and then finally the rule of the Aetolian League. And Byzantium's history is tied up with these institutions and all those states that control the city and the chaos. One of the reasons it's so difficult to study. But from the 7th century BC, the Bosporus faced a migratory wave of Cimmerians and Scythians, or Proto-Russians, if we might, as Gumilev would call it. The result was that the northern Black Sea Scythians developed in the territory of Byzantium to some extent near the Crimea. Trade and industrial colonization stretched from the Golden Horn to the Sea of Azov and the Lower Don. So the Sarmatians and the Getae on the Lower Don were also involved in the profitable trade in this area. We have to follow the economics. We're talking about these kind of foundations. But from roughly 550 to 300 BC, Ionian colonization, the Bosporus, gives rise to systems that did create powerful governments. Spartan colonists against the Scythian state from the Dnieper to the Dardanelles created a violent combination that placed the region almost always in chaos. So the continuing economic and political ties with the Don region, with trade contacts reaching the Middle Don, southwestern Urals even, linked Byzantium with Russia prior to Constantine. The Bosporus, to a great extent, was a transmitter of Greek culture to Central Asia and southern Russia at the time. And this may be, you know, this may be a bit of a stretch here, but from, you know, 400 to 300 BC, you do have an eastern, you do have a, you know, the political and cultural relations do move east. And the Sea of Azov became a major destination. The Bosporus became increasingly wealthy, but still increasingly unstable. Then, roughly from 300 to the birth of Christ, the Bosporus kingdom focused on trade with the new, well, what we could call the new masters of the steppe, the Sarmatians, living in Asiatic Scythia on the border with the European Don. The trade network near the Don, beginning in the 3rd century BC, was centered in the city of Tanis. But this Bosporus kingdom became dependent on Pontus, which then eventually leads to the region's domination by Mithridates VI against Rome, who was, I think, better known. And the non-Latin people looked to the Bosporus against the Western Empire. So the fourth period now, from really to 250 AD, you have a growing Bosporus region maintaining its own local dynasty based on contacts with the Sarmatians and the Alans of the Don region. The Bosporus was firmly a part of Rome as a dependent state, and she did maintain a fragile autonomy, you might say, and never became a Roman province as such. The only one of the Mediterranean states to be able to say that. So, but inclusion into the Roman Mediterranean universe in the 1st century BC led to the penetration of certain aspects of ancient Judaism, and then later, of course, Christianity, and then later than that, Islam. And the Bosporus becomes a launch pad, essentially, of Asian trade to the Baltics and all points between. And I know that this you know, this sounds chaotic because it is. And I'm trying to establish some kind of consistency in economic relationships here. We're talking about a very significant era, the era of Greek colonization of the Black Sea coast and the founding of these new cities. Greece is not known for having a lot of arable land. And so when you have a growing population, there needs to be movement outward. And these new cities were related to the Aegean city-states. I'm talking about, you know, the largest of them were Heraclea Pontica and Sinope on the south coast. You have Apollonia and Istria in the west, and Olbia were settled on the north coast. The Dioscuridia Phasis was founded on the east coast of the Black Sea. And all of these were geographically close to Byzantium and are very much a part of her history. They had often different interests, but they were all speaking Greek. But these Greek cities in the northern Black Sea, they were an integral part of the Hellenistic world. They worked closely in every respect with the countries in the Balkans, too. Asia Minor and even Egypt. But the specificity of the historical development of the region was determined by two essential factors. The close relations with local tribal associations or states like the Thracians, the Scythians, Iberians, whatever, all of whom had a visible impact on the economic and cultural development of the area, but also the drive to create alliances. We're talking about the leagues, things that precipitated the Peloponnesian War, for example. And they were very important in the Black Sea region. But I don't know if we're going to get to that today, the concept of the league from an ideological point of view and what that means. But such leading centers, 5th, 4th centuries BC, Sinope and Heraclea in the south coast, and the Pentacapion to the north. The Black Sea was, you know, you cannot stress its significance enough. And it became an active area, very active area of Ionian colonization, especially in the founding of the city of Miletus, as many Black Sea cities were Milesian colonies. So the issue, after the completion of the Greco-Persian War for the liberation of Ionia, the cities of Asia Minor from Persia, the Delian League, of course, increases in power and extended its influence to the Black Sea area. So the Greek world is giving a new lease on life. And Athenian power had new allies, including Sinope, Amis, Heraclea, Apollonius, Istria, Tyre, Olbia, Nymphaeum. But in order to maintain its influence there, Athens maintained its fleet to control any kind of oligarchical development, which, of course, is always a problem here because these were fairly wealthy trading cities. By 437 BC, an expedition attempting to consolidate Athenian power in Sinope, and then the Athenians themselves having a tough time with 424, the residents of Heraclea withdrew from the Delian League and declared the independence of the city. Athenian attempts to restore its supremacy failed. Clearly there's parallels with our own day, although on very different circumstances. Heraclea gained its independence. And then the Peloponnesian War saw the defeat of Athens, as we all know, and the Delian League falls to pieces. And the cities of Sinope, you know, all the Athenian allies among the Black Sea cities now were free to do as they pleased. So from the 4th century BC on, they were able to maximize their economic and political prosperity. Sinope is significant because it was made up in part by a very thick forest with rich deposits. You had iron, silver, lead, you had copper. The soil and climate were favorable. Olive and grapes were, of course, a staple. It became a very important city. And It was surrounded by mountains. It protected the coastal lowlands from invaders. But as the city became richer and stronger, it also became a target. And so Sinope began to develop the southeast coast. And she almost became herself a leader of an alliance. Towns like Clotiora and Carisant and Trebizond joined her. And controlling the east coast of the Black Sea, Sinope, we're talking about the 4th century here, had great economic potential and political influence around the Black Sea region. I mean, Sinope had a monopoly in the supply of wood, iron ore, and other metals, as well as a special, made a special paint that was unique to them, not to mention her olive oil exports. And what's happening is now you had a direct sea route across the Black Sea, which began at Sinope and moved through Cape Carambis, ended in the Crimea. And, you know, Sinopean products were distributed among farmers and nomads who inhabited the steppes in the northern Black Sea area. And in exchange for that, steppe nomads re-exported cattle products, skins, and grain. Point is, of course, these were becoming very powerful outposts of Greek civilization. They were coming, you know, closer, vaguely closer to the time of Christ here, a few centuries. Sinope became the largest transit center in the Black Sea, and her military superiority was able to protect the flow of goods from all over the place. The inner regions of Asia Minor, Greek cities of the Aegean Basin, etc. And trading was with the nearby Bosphorus Kingdom and Olbia. The word itself means wealthy and happy. It's the colonization. The Black Sea allowed it to control vast resources in Asia Minor. And it became one of the most powerful economic and political centers of the Greek world. And that region became what we call a local hegemon. And the second largest center was Heraclea Pontica, founded by Meagra in roughly 560 BC. There you had workable land. Grapes and wine, obviously, were typical. And this is near the straits connecting the Black Sea to the Aegean Sea, and that certainly qualifies as a predecessor to Byzantium. And it was a major transit hub for everything. So the trade between Sinope and Heraclea was peaceful, really only because they agreed to limit their spheres of influence. In addition to the Crimean Peninsula, the Heraclean commercial and political influence also penetrated to the southern part of the Western Black Sea. Now, as always, as these precursors to the Byzantine Empire began to develop, and they developed rapidly, and these are highly literate, very sophisticated societies, the eternal fight shows itself between the Greek nation, the population, the true aristocracy, and oligarchy. So in this case, the contradiction was really between civilian and military powers, and not in the normal course of events. The city was characterized by the dominance of the Heraclean military landowning aristocracy that controlled the entire state. Now, of course, we're going back a little bit. And this is, you know, but eventually, this was broken, and they all took advantage. Going back a little bit, they took advantage of the difficulties of Athens during the Peloponnesian War and rebelled, and seceded from the Delian League. But as I said, that the destruction of that league meant quite a bit, and it was that sort of freedom that allowed them to prosper like this. And now the other significant matter. The northern Black Sea neighborhood saw the Hellenization, or at least Greek influence, amongst the non-Greeks in the area. Now, they called it the barbarian periphery, but that's not a judgment on them. The Scythians certainly can never be called barbarians, the Sarmatians. The 4th century BC, the vast region of the Black Sea steppe, have these, can only be called really fluid nomadic tribes. Sarmatians heading down the Tanais River, moving to the west, of course, clash with the Scythians, occupying their territory. The Sarmatians move further westward to the mouth of the Danube, the height of its state, the Scythia Minor, or the southwestern steppe. The Scythians in the steppe near the Crimea were pushed along by the constantly changing, this kaleidoscope of military power there, helped populate what we now call the modern south of Ukraine. So, by the middle of the 3rd century BC, you had a strong Scythian kingdom whose capital was Simferopol, roughly in the Greek near the Greek city of Kherson, Theodosius, and still even the Bosporus. And the Sarmatians fought Scythian military activity in the north and east. And so the Scythians were forced to move their activity in the south, and unfortunately against the Greek cities. But part of the allure here was not so much for conquest, but for the rich trade and manufactures, which have long, you know, attracted the attention of the Scythian elite. And so the Greek mentality here developed to, in the process of deflecting of the Scythian threat, military threat, it caused them to seek alliances and patrons among the more powerful states of the Hellenistic world. So the major centers of the northern Black Seas, Olbia, Kherson, and Bosporus, and their internal and external situation to the 2nd century, had been changed. Olbia was experiencing serious economic difficulties, its internal capacity undermined by the attack and siege of the city by the troops under Zoperon, one of the generals of Alexander the Great. And in 331 BC, the city was able to fight off and to fight for its independence, but the siege itself devastated its life. But the weakening of the potential, the economic life of Olbia just did nothing more than invite the Sarmatians and Scythians, who were constantly in Olbian territory. But the digs, there's been a few archaeological digs by the middle of the 3rd century BC. The rural settlements along the banks of the Dnieper and Bug, the estuaries have disappeared. So what looks like the elimination of Olbia's economic potential did undermine the economy, the surrounding areas too. And it harms all forms of production, the value of the currency, and creates disruptions in monetary circulation, which is very significant. And so as the city got more broke, it became more violent. And as always, the same battle shows itself. The sharp stratification among two classes. The city produced a small group of very wealthy, but not your typical wealthy. Like you saw in Athens, rather than see their city die, they used their own personal funds to finance the expenses of the city budget, supplied the population with what they needed, donated massive sums to the city treasury, and a distribution and the rebuilding of the infrastructure. Everything was done at their own expense. And when I'm asked about the nature of ethno-nationalism, there is no other motivation for them to do this. The liturgios, to some extent we get the concept of liturgy from the Athenian, I guess became a tradition for the wealthy to use their own funds to support public works when necessary, and going broke sometimes in the process. Protogenes was elected mayor, the chief executive, and helped the city recover. He was, of course, one of these people. Olbia, with great difficulty, defended itself against the steppe tribes, but the Scythians eventually took over in the 2nd century. But even the submission didn't bring relief to the city. It disrupted everything. And when it became established, though, Olbia turned to the famed Mithridates, the sixth, the king of Pontus, who I think many of you know, was able to liberate the city from Scythia. He left his own garrison there. And then, of course, under his Pontic garrison, the town recovered. But as soon as Mithridates was forced to withdraw, the city soon became then a ghost town. And unfortunately, that's how these go. Now, I understand that, you know, some of this can be very dry when you're coming across it for the first time. Unfortunately, you know, history can be that way. Nations, to a great extent, come into existence because tribal units of very similar language and customs realize they have more to gain by cooperation than conflict. Often it's a very powerful external force that forces them to see this. But that's what's happening here. Again, you're talking about a tremendous level of Greek nationalism. Again, that causes these men to spend their personal money on infrastructure and campaign. And a lot of these guys in the assembly, they vote for war and they personally go and fight it, which is, of course, the opposite of what you have today. Democratic systems are mercenary systems. We're also talking about really what is the core of what we vaguely call Western civilization, which is coming into existence here. But to be a core of anything, you have to have a strong economic foundation. So you have these societies, very similar. These are all Greek-speaking. They're influencing everyone around them. They're clearly admired. Their political systems are kind of all over the place, but in general you have either a single military ruler or an aristocracy of some type. When the economy grows very quickly, there you have the danger of oligarchy. But oligarchy tends to come into existence after the moral code breaks down, usually because of warfare. And this we've talked about before, whether it be in Afghanistan, the American Civil War, when you're surrounded by death and deceit, you know, morals fall apart. The only thing that seems to matter is deviousness and violence. You know, life is cheap. Oligarchy can only come into existence in that kind of vacuum. But so long as the culture is very strong and literacy is high in the best sense of the term here, that's really hard to do. Now, Kherson, which comes up in ancient history quite often, medieval history, founded by colonists from Heraclea in the 5th century, was a tiny backwater. But you see a sharp increase in the strength of the Khersonese state, which soon made the city into a major center of Greek northern Black Sea life. And it began in the 4th century. This growth was able, you know, she was able to absorb vast areas in northwestern Crimea, including Scythian areas. Its urban area was reconstructed to look like a normal Greek city, clear separation among the rectangular grid of streets, the agora, the Acropolis, the port area, and the guild craft quarters and the streets where the guilds functioned. This is how this economy was developing. This is how the colonists were. This is the system that we're bringing to the world here. This is the, if you're going to colonize, this is the best form. I mean, they weren't displacing anybody. There was no one actually there. They created their own civilizations. But Kherson built its own mint and theater. You know, which in the theater is extremely important because the Greek plays and the culture was transmitted this way. and what was uncovered, really about 1,500 could fit there. And they did have urban sprawl, but they ended up using thick walls and high towers, the best line of strategic defense, very competently put together. So Kherson quickly becomes one of the best armed cities in the area, and its own fortification became the model for Greek colonies elsewhere. And, this was a, what you may want to call a social nationalist system. In Kherson, there was a surveying of the arable land, which, of course, to Greeks is always a big deal. So they created fair and roughly equal allotments of land between 10 and 30 hectares each. And this is how it was distributed. And so profitable farming just northwest of the Crimea was very quickly established. This kind of equality can only make sense in this, you know, colonies tend to be nationalist. You can't get any more British than the inhabitants of the Falklands. When you're kind of far away, you hang together. And that's why some of these systems were able to work so well, maintaining the culture, creating this level of equality here, where you actually distribute, you know, a certain level of land for each unit, for each extended family, and becoming very profitable. And horticulture and viticulture, of course, became dominant. And then, unfortunately, though, they were using slave labor in certain places. But very quickly, this backwater developed workshops, the variety of pottery, all the dishes and tiles and pipes, weaving, dyeing, metal forges, the construction of urban buildings and fortifications were extraordinary and rapid. And this contributed to the development of the symbolism of the Hellenistic world. So because of this, trade relations took a straight path, the Black Sea to the southern towns like Sinope and Heraklion, and then it reached into the cities of Balkan Greece too. But Kherson established strong trade relations with Olbia, the Bosporus cities with the Scythians. So it was mostly an inter-Greek matter. The Scythians were also, you know, advanced themselves. But again, it's significant to point out in the 2nd century BC, the ruling strata in Kherson was homogeneous. And even when you had a development of any kind of sharp property stratification, like you had in Olbia, it was checked by this intense nationalism. Now, she did develop a slave economy, but that's at the classical Greek type. And the slaves were the main producers in the rural estates and in craft shops in the city. This was the Athenian way. But beyond that, Kherson developed what we might call a democratic aristocratic system. And it became like so much in the ancient Greek mentality. The National Assembly was a supreme body, but which was very large, but the greater power rested with the chosen council of 30 members. So the day-to-day version of the assembly. And direct management of the city affairs had elected magistrates, you know, generals, administrators of all types, overseers, then the treasury and acquisitions offices of the state. But backed by powerful fortifications, a significant military and economic plan repelled the Scythians throughout this whole period of time. However, it did require full mobilization to do this. And as always, they can't be isolated. And searching for allies, it was Byzantium within the Bosporus regime that, along with the Sarmatian tribes, then eventually filled that role. But the Scythians, as most of you know, were on the way out, 180 roughly BC. The monarch in Pontus eventually eliminated the Scythians. But yet, you know, the steppe being what it is, this great large place, newer tribes similar to the Scythians were always there to replace them. So you had a constant grinding war of attrition with the seemingly endless foe And this is why, and it forced them to appeal to Mithridates, the Sixth of Pontus. And it led to them becoming a very important ally, which was a good thing from their point of view. But the economy of Byzantium itself, which is still a small city at the time, was exporting grain. And as always, the viniculture and winemaking. And there's examples of many wineries, excavated estates, both in European and Asian parts of the Bosporus, compensated for any kind of problems in the economy. And as always, this any kind of excess, surplus, went to the building of urban craftsmen, new products, new designs of sailing vessels, linking them with Rhodes and Pergamon in that sense. This is how societies are built. These were literate, motivated colonists of the Greek mainland, Miletus and elsewhere, who brought the Greek way of life throughout these regions. And again, think of the British in the Falklands. The farther away you get, the more nationalist you become. And they became more and more, but it was very difficult. You couldn't be, like, for example, the early American colonists, very different story. It's extremely difficult to call across the Atlantic Ocean. That was not the case here. This was on a much smaller scale. In the Bosporus Kingdom, and we're talking about Byzantium now, 2nd century BC, you start seeing a deterioration of the coinage, difficulty in monetary policy, and the weakening of the state itself. And one of the things that happened, or at least one theory, is that the Hellenistic Bosporus saw an influx of Scythians in the social structure as part of the ruling class, and the reliance on slavery in the hinterlands played a role here. In the political organization of the Bosporus, the elite was always very insecure. And so as this occurs, the role of the imperial executive increases. So, in the 4th century BC, before the Bosporus rulers called themselves Archons, due to the fact that local conquests made Byzantium one of the largest states in the area, it was not small anymore. Following the lead of other Hellenistic rulers, the Bosporus formed a royal land fund, they call, at the expense of the occupied territories. And then they established from this cities such as Tanis, as well as military and agricultural settlements all over the place. But the Bosporus regime, which included Byzantium, was an integral part of this Hellenistic world. And it was almost a core of it. But things changed. Going back to the 2nd century, the Bosporus, as well as other cities, northern Black Sea coasts, experienced a crisis. For one thing, a plague ravaged certain cities, which didn't help matters. Against the background of impoverishment, you had the exacerbation of social contradictions. You had a rebellion of the Scythian population, and a supporter of the Bosporan king, Peresad, Savmak V, was one of the leaders of this. But the ruling dynasty there had no means to deal with this kind of crisis. Under these conditions, the dominant elite of the Bosporus society appealed to help the mighty Mithridates. The Mithridates. There's a whole bunch of ways I've heard that, including Mithridates, pronounced in the past. Professors and everything else, I have no idea. Anyway. But they were quite willing to give up their independence and bring their society under the control of Mithridates. The same military that successfully defeated the Scythian army that once threatened Cherson was then sent to the Bosporus to crush the rebellion of Savmak and some of the famous generals under the emperor, bringing all under the subjection of Pontus. Prior to this crisis, maybe one of the causes, the Bosporan kingdom was exceptionally complex. Many tribes had converged here because of its wealth at some point. An administrative structure became very complex. Its population is typical, mostly urban, but didn't have a majority of Greeks. You had immigrants from the Balkans, Asia Minor, other Black Sea cities, and local tribes, and created a government that couldn't be ethnic. It was a Greek city, only in the sense that its ruling citizens spoke the language, and they became leading citizens for their trading contacts with Greece proper, and in Greater Greece and Asia Minor and South Italy. But still, for a time, they had considerable economic resources. They created a stable economy and substantial revenue. And this is something that, you know, the Bosporus bread industry in the 4th century BC developed. After the Peloponnesian War, Athens was deprived of their holdings in Sicily. The Bosporus rulers created a relationship with them and revitalized their economy entirely based on that. But all of this was, for the most part, a Greek phenomenon. Active trade relations with the Greek centers, the grain trade, contributed to the development of agriculture, all around the Bosporus cities and in large areas of localities. Kerch in the Taman Peninsula, rural settlements grew up, that grew into farmsteads and previously unoccupied land. And you developed a kind of what might later be called a feudal or the manor system. Prior to the crisis, the Bosporus, we might as well call it the Byzantine society, was very prosperous, and it had immense political influence. It had an impressive military and economic foundation. They were able to establish friendly relations with the Greek cities that we're talking about in the Black Sea, Sinope, Heraklea, Balkan Greece, and the Bosporus dynasty, the dynasts, by the end of the 4th century, claimed a leading role in the whole Black Sea area. And one of the leaders here was Emulius, who started ruling about 304, who was one of the founders of this policy of hegemony. Emulius, the result of the civil war, concentrated all power to himself and spread his power throughout the area. The Macedonian commander, Lysimachus, he assisted in taking the city of Kalatith. Now, of course, in debt to them, the Macedonians helped strengthen their fleet, which was rationally used to destroy their enemies, especially pirates. So, you know, relative to ancient Byzantium, we're talking about the beginning of the Byzantine Empire, prior to its Christianization. These are fairly small states. These were, however, very wealthy and sophisticated states. The Bosporan Kingdom was not as homogenous as the other ones were, but it doesn't matter because this was still an inter-Greek matter. They demonstrated that the main strategic points were economic and based on the sea, which was a matter of necessity. This may mean trouble for Rome later on, which was the land power. But Rome eventually needed another approach to subdue the area. And this is one of the reasons that Rome took Greece so seriously. Because, you know, they had the literacy, the experience with complex bureaucracy, but only on a small scale. And maybe next time we'll talk about Mithridates, who is worth talking about, who I have not spoken about before. I've mentioned him in passing here. As one of the greatest generals of the ancient world. Now, I've always been an admirer of Sulla and the development of the land-based Roman Empire, but that doesn't mean we could take anything away from his Greek opponents. So for now, we're going to end here. and we'll do part two of this and try to bring all of this together. It's an extremely complicated history. Next time we'll talk more about the political theory here. It's difficult to talk about the dry administrative, the procedures, the development of these states. But understand what's happening. This is the building of Hellenistic civilization. This is, without an empire, what the Greeks will do. The creation of, this huge, you look at the map, these developments in the Black Sea and elsewhere, every one of which, highly literate, very successful, and overwhelmingly homogenous. People admire the Byzantine Empire for lasting for 1,000 years, and there's a reason for that. You should admire them. But this is the foundation. This is the building of the Greek mind that the Christian message, of course, is going to complete and bring to its final terminus. The faith, of course, maintained Byzantine. And you see, prior to it, the self-interest, which created these chaotic shifting sands of alliances and leagues in this very chaotic period of time. But it doesn't matter, because you have the development of the Greek mind here in the best sense. It's late, of course. We're coming to the age of Christ. We're just a few centuries away. But, of course, Plato was, long before this. But this is what happens afterwards. This is what happens when a highly advanced, highly literate civilization who has yet to come to Christ or yet to understand him begins expressing itself. All of these cities were successful. All of these cities had enemies everywhere. But all of these cities were well aware that they had an intense Greek ethnic identity, which they were painfully aware of, especially in their clashing with local tribes, especially the larger ones, the Scythians and the Sarmatians and the rest. This Greek identity continued to develop. And, we're talking about here, of course, the economic foundations of what becomes the empire of St. Constantine, and was developed as such by the great Theodosius. This is the foundation. So next time we're going to deal with the more philosophical side of these things. But this is how civilization happens. This is how these things are built. This is an extraordinary people. This is the heritage of Europe at its very core. This is the world post-Plato, Aristotle, and the building of and heading course to the conquest of Rome, which put an end to this chaos, put a necessary end to this chaos. So, again, thank you everyone who was praying for me, as I was very sick. It was, I wouldn't wish this on, my ex-wife's lawyers. I wouldn't wish this on anyone. This was misery. And for those of you suffering from disease yourself, I appreciate it. And my Lord, I'm glad this is largely over. Everything is back to normal. I'll, talk to you again tomorrow on Thursday with Sven. Everything will be fine. Thank you again for your patience, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.